I'm Duncan Strauss. Really delighted to bring you another edition of Talking Animals, in which we'll speak with Deborah Nelson, a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist who wrote a major expose about the Ringling Circus for the November-December issue of Mother Jones magazine. Not coincidentally, Ringling opens its camp engagement today. First, though, as always, we're kicking off the show with an animal tune. This is Steve Martin and the Steep Canyon Rangers with Rare Bird Alert here on Talking Animals. Happy New Year. Hello. Good morning. Steve Martin and the Steep Canyon Rangers with Rare Bird Alert, a jaunty instrumental animal song. Tease us into today's edition of Talking Animals. My name is Duncan Strauss, here with our program, and is devoted to all subjects in the animal kingdom. Before we go any further, I want to say a big thank you to Flea, who sat in for me last week and did an absolutely stellar job. I mean, we'll steal his idea of having folks call in doing animal sounds. Cool. Anyways, great, great job. Thanks, Flea. And I'm now back, rested, refreshed, and ready to dive into a new year of Talking Animals shows. In fact, in just a few minutes, we'll be speaking with today's guest, Deborah Nelson, a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist who wrote a major investigative piece about the Ringling Brothers Circus for the November-December issue of Mother Jones magazine, entitled The Cruelest Show on Earth. Nelson's article represents a year-long investigation into the circus operation. And every year, really, since I launched Talking Animals in Southern California in 2003, I've presented a show pegged to Ringling's local engagement. So today's program with Deborah Nelson extends that tradition, in that Ringling's Tampa stint opens tonight. We'll talk Ringling with Deborah in a few moments here on Talking Animals. I'll alert you to some protests coming up along those lines and more. As usual, also welcome your questions and comments at 813-239-9663 or by email at dj@wmnf.org. Also a bit later in the show, we'll step into the comedy corner, which, of course, involves animal comedy. We'll play Name That Animal Tune. The winner will receive a David Bowie Best Of CD, a nod to our three-night David Bowie tribute happening this weekend, Friday at the State, Saturday at Skipper's, Sunday at the Cock and Bull. And, of course, we'll hear another animal song or two. But right now, it's time for animal news and announcements. Look at items of interest in animal news, as well as announcements of local events on the horizon, produced as always by the Talking Animals award-winning Rip and Read News Department. Our first item sort of involves a national story, or at least national coverage, of a local story, by which I refer to the whole brouhaha that popped up over the The Farewell to Cheetah. You may have heard of Red, the chimp who ostensibly portrayed Cheetah in the Tarzan movies with Johnny Weissmuller, died recently at the Suncoast Primate Sanctuary. But that news was barely reported before a lot of people said, hey, wait a minute. Hard to imagine that chimp in that situation was the cheetah. Since he was, about 80 when he passed away or so. Anyway, as one measure of all the discussion and skepticism surrounding it, the New York Times dispatched a reporter down in Palm Harbor here and to look into it. And, that story is available online if you'd like to delve in further. But it's interesting. It raises some questions. I may or may not answer some. Who knows? But fun with Cheetah, nonetheless. Locally, although disappeared on my side of the state, on the Palm Beach Post. And this is kind of a menace well beyond that. But anyway, it says, headlined, lionfish wipeout deemed unlikely. Non-native lionfish that invaded Palm Beach County waters about 15 months ago have become well-established in a variety of water depths, meaning the beautiful Pacific Ocean fish with venomous spines and few natural predators probably is here to stay, experts say. Quote, within the bounds of current knowledge of the invasion, lionfish eradication is not likely, said Ladd Aikens, director of special projects for the Key Largo-based nonprofit Reef Environmental Education Foundation. It tracks the spread of lionfish and organizes harvesting competitions to help control their numbers. The good news, divers have been able to control the spread of lionfish in specific areas, such as the protected reefs and the Florida Keys National Marine Sanctuary, Aiken said. Florida International University researchers found lionfish in the Loxahatchee River in August 2010, documenting the fish's first infestation in an East Coast estuary. They found 211 lionfish in the Loxahatchee between August 2010 and April 2011. Goes down from there, more and more lionfish. Here's something that came from PetMD.com. New Year's resolutions for pet owners. I'll read at least a few of these. Number one, pet-proof your home. As you may already know, pets get into anything and everything. Keep poisons and other dangerous items in secure places, preferably in a locked cabinet or in a room that is out of the animal's reach. Number two, get your pet ID'd. Whether it is a tag or a microchip, identifying your pet and your contact information will help your chances of having your pet returned should it become lost. Especially in the case of lost dogs and cats, just remember to keep the contact information current. Number three, socialize your pet. Don't worry, you don't have to create a Facebook profile for them. But like children, your pet can become destructive and unmanageable when she is not given enough attention or is not allowed to socialize with other animals of her kind. Obedience training is just what your pet needs to learn some manners. And remember, it's never too late to train an animal. Number four, groom your pet. There's nothing worse than a stinky pet. I'm just reading. Stay on top of her grooming routine. Bathe her, brush her coat, clip her nails, all these things will make her the envy of your block, and if you haven't noticed yet, your pet is usually happier when she is clean and pretty. Number five, have your pet spayed or neutered. Of course, we all know spaying and neutering helps decrease the population of strays, but do you know many veterinarians believe it helps benefit the animal's health, too? Among the health benefits, a decrease in testicular cancer, prostate problems, urine marking, and inner dog or inner cat aggression for males, and a decrease in mammary cancer, uterine cancer, and ovarian cancer for females. And it goes on from there. You can find it if you want to hear the other five. Again, the source was PetMD.com. This is in the Washington Post by way of the Associated Press. Headline, cat survives two euthanasia attempts in Utah Animal Shelter's gas chamber, now has new home. Stray cat that survived two trips to a Utah Animal Shelter's gas chamber now has a new home. Officials at West Valley City's Animal Shelter in Utah say the cat named Andrea hadn't been adopted for 30 days when shelter officials tried to put her to death in October. She survived, so they gassed her again. Shelter officials detected no vital signs and presumed she was dead after the second try, so they put her in a plastic bag in a cooler. But when they checked the bag, they saw she had vomited on herself and had hypothermia, but was alive. the shelter then decided to stop killing her. Or stop trying to kill her. Good call. More locally, animal-based charities wants to remind you they've got a few events coming up, including one this weekend. January 7th, noon to 5 p.m. is the second annual Barkerilla at Gasper's Grotto. Takes place from noon to 5 p.m. There's a pooch parade at 2:30 p.m. and all kinds of other cool activities, games, pet photos, eats, more. So you can find out more, of course, by going to animalbasedcharities.org. Also on the local scene, you might remember or be familiar with from other ways, Sue Pike, the so-called animal talker. She's a regular guest on E-Love's show here on WMNF, and she's been on Talking Animals. And she's based in New York, but periodically comes here to present programs and seminars and training and stuff, and usually sits in with E-Love and Will, I think, in this case as well. But she's heading to the Tampa Clearwater area for a period of January 14th through the 22nd. So there'll be all kinds of events, and best way to find out more about that or get involved or sign up if you'd like is going to SuePikeEnergy.com. SuePikeEnergy.com, her new website. Another story that appeared in the New York Times, I think this was actually on Monday. Headline, Animal Studies Cross Campus to Lecture Hall. And it's a fairly solid in-depth piece. I'm not going to read it, but kind of really just noting the growing trend on college campuses of courses dealing with animals, animals and people, animal science, and other things, and a lot of books and other studies that sort of hook into that. Really well done and interesting. One thing I found that it didn't mention, and maybe this is because he's on my mind at the moment, but Bob Barker, yeah, The Price is Right, Bob Barker, has funded over several years' time many, many courses and I think even some endowed chairs, both at law schools and at other universities along these very lines. I mean, to me, he was sort of even a pioneer of sort of helping establish and advance these things. So he's not mentioned in this story, but I'm mentioning it now partly because he will be our guest on Talking Animals next week. There's just a lot more stuff he's been doing. He was on the show about 5 years ago, and I just struck recently by how many varied and different and important things he's been helping with and helping to underwrite in particular. So I thought we would talk about that, but some of those very much include some of these academic programs that he was, again, out in front of, really. All right, well, if we have time, we'll get into a few more in towards the latter part of the show. But let's step right now into the Talking Animals Comedy Corner, which, as always, involves animal-oriented comedy. This is Louis C.K., from my standpoint, the comedy man of 2011, so many ways. And this is a piece I'm calling Lions on today's Comedy Corner on Talking Animals.
And if you are an idiot, you should be selected out. Not by a committee, but by lions. Like, there should be... Like, I saw this woman on a plane once. This woman gets on the plane. She has red shorts and high heels and a little shirt. And she's like, you know, like... I swear, if she had made a sound, it would have been like, "Gah!" Like, she just was... And she's got the bags, and they're way too wide to fit through the aisle. So instead of picking them up or going sideways, she just goes, "Eh," and just walks away from them. And just... And there's the flight attendant who has, like, rubber shoes, just boring working woman, looks at her, and she's, like, disgusted. But she picks up the bags for her, and she follows her on the plane. I realize this woman's going to have men who want her and women who hate her helping her throughout her life. She's always going to do okay, even though she's worthless. There should be some There should be some element where she could maybe get eaten by a lion. Like, we need that. I think we need to reintroduce lions into human society as a variable. Like, we should breed lions and just set them loose in the cities and the malls. Every mall should have, like, 4 lions. And you don't know where they are. It might be Victoria's Secret or Cold Stone Creamery. You don't know. If there were lions around, everyone would have to be smarter and more interesting. You couldn't just be a fat pig and Carl's Jr. pigging out, because a lion might eat you. You have to be quick and graze and be nimble. You couldn't walk around looking at your phone because you might get mauled by a lion. You have to be sharp. People would be smarter, and they'd be more interesting, because everybody would have a cool story about someone who got eaten by a lion. Or how you had to avoid, I had to climb 2 fences on the way to work because of the lions. Everyone would have a great story. I was at the Yankees game, and a lion ate the Kansas City Royals. He ate the whole team.
All right. That was Louis C.K. with a piece on calling the lions, taken from a letter of parents last summer. I'm Duncan Schultz. This is Talking Animals. Our website is talkinganimals.net. It's nearly time to speak with today's guest, Deborah Nelson. As I touched on earlier, Deborah is a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist who wrote a major expose about the Ringling Brothers Circus for the November-December issue of Mother Jones Magazine, an article that represents a year-long investigation. This conversation with Deborah extends a Talking Animals tradition began the first year of the show in 2003, presenting a show each year examining Ringling Peg to its local engagement. Indeed, Ringling's Tampa stint opens tonight. There are protests planned, which I'll address in the coming minutes here as well. So with a reminder that we invite you to join the conversation by calling 813-239-9663 or emailing us at dj@wmnf.org. Let's welcome Deborah Nelson to Talking Animals. Good morning, Deborah.
Hey, good morning.
Thanks so much for joining us on Talking Animals.
Happy to be here.
Great, great, great. So, okay, so you're currently senior lecturer and director of the Carnegie Seminar at the Philip Merrill College of Journalism at the University of Maryland. That's a mouthful. And we mentioned a few times already that you're a Pulitzer winner. So maybe in sort of the audio equivalent of time-lapse photography, maybe you could just sort of zoom us through your newspaper jobs that precede your current position, including a bit about the project for which you shared the Pulitzer.
Okay. Well, I got here at the university in 2006, and that was after 5 years as the investigative editor for the Washington Bureau of the Los Angeles Times. And before that, I was at the Washington Post, and before that, the Seattle Times, and before that, the Chicago Sun-Times. So it all adds up to about 30 years of journalism in at newspapers, doing investigative reporting primarily.
Yeah.
During that time, and the Pulitzer was from the Seattle Times. I did a series of stories on HUD's, you know, the federal government's housing program for reservations.
Cool.
I found widespread abuse and misuse of the funds, both by the government regulators and by powerful tribal officials.
Right. Well, so as a former print journalist and sort of current media junkie myself, I just don't think it's possible to overstate the sort of ongoing impact and prestige of winning a Pulitzer. And I also feel it functions a bit differently for someone employed at a newspaper or magazine, sort of engaged in the daily practice of journalism, versus someone like yourself who's teaching and overseeing and occasionally tackling pieces. I mean, do you feel there may be, therefore, kind of an added impact or gravity to whatever piece that you do then happen to tackle, because, you know, precisely because you're not sort of writing, you know, every day the way you were during all those newspaper years?
Well, first of all, I've got to tell you that one of the biggest advantages of winning a Pulitzer,
mm-hmm,
is that when you're an investigative reporter, people are always accusing you. The people you're investigating are always accusing you of doing what you're doing to win a Pulitzer.
Oh, to win another one, you mean?
Well, to win one before you win
one. Oh, I see.
They're
okay.
Always, you know, they're always accusing you of, you know, you're just trying to win a Pulitzer. and of course, that's like, you know, doing your financial planning based on winning the lottery.
Yeah.
But the nice thing about winning one is that when people say that, you could say, no, already been there, done that. You know,
right.
I got my Pulitzer. Really, I'm doing this because I think this is an important issue to bring to light. So having a Pulitzer is, first of all, good for that.
Mm-hmm.
That it takes away that, you know, that people try to take away from what you're writing by suggesting there's an ulterior motive. And there isn't. You know, my motive, and most investigative journalists I know, we do what we do, and it's a hard road to take in journalism, investigative reporting. We do what we do because we care about the issues that we write about. But the other thing about once you win a Pulitzer, it, of course, it can add to what you're writing. It can bring more attention to what you're writing.
Sure.
So I think that's great too. It's nice to be a Pulitzer Prize winner for my, you know.
Right.
Right. That's nice to have that at the end of my name, you know.
Absolutely.
Pulitzer Prize winner. But I've got to say that it would be hollow if it didn't also help me shine the light on some of the issues that I write about.
Sure. Well, it's interesting because, I mean, I that what you said about people thinking you're up to something pre-Pulitzer, that's just so interesting because I guess my thought was sort of almost flipped around, which is that, you know, having won one and, you know, currently and for some years, obviously, you know, teaching, but therefore not maybe writing as often as you were in the newspaper years. To me, it seems like it would almost lend more like, wow, she's won a Pulitzer and she's not writing as often as she was. So now she's taking on a piece. Therefore, that must mean, you know, something more. So I guess, you know, maybe.
Oh, I see. Yeah.
But, so I guess with that in mind, whether that's sort of a half-baked premise or not, I guess the key question at this point is
well,
why
I think your premise is a good one. That is, I'm not doing as many projects as I did before. I've been doing one. I probably did one or two a year before. And, so when I take on something, it has to be what I consider a really important issue.
Right. So that might be the perfect time for us to jump into why, therefore, Ringling.
Yeah, why Ringling? I had, you know, I've long had an interest in investigating environmental issues. Probably every two or three investigations I've done, I've tried to do something on the environment, on natural resources. And I never tackled the issue of animals directly as they, you know, play into the world and into the environment. But this particular issue, so I already walked in, I already had this long-standing interest in the environment.
Mm-hmm.
And I overheard a conversation about between some, you know, a couple of people talking about this ongoing lawsuit against Feld Entertainment. That they've been sued under the Endangered Species Act for their treatment of elephants in the circus. And as I started, you know, it just caught my attention. I thought, well, that's interesting. It's interesting to me as an investigative reporter for a couple of reasons. One is that it had to do with nature, with the environment.
Mm-hmm.
And I hadn't taken on a story like that for a few years. And also it involved a legal case. And the reason that a legal case is attractive to an investigative journalist is that when there's a lawsuit, and this is one that had been going on for years, those lawsuits often serve as a lot of documentation that you can't get your hands on otherwise. So the ingredients were there, I thought, for an important piece.
Mm-hmm.
That could take advantage of 10 years. In this case, there were 10 years of documentation, records from the government, records from Feld Entertainment that had accumulated through this lawsuit and several others. As I began looking into this, I discovered a few other lawsuits that had also produced a lot of documentation of about how Feld Entertainment treats its elephants and how the federal government oversees Feld Entertainment's treatment of its elephants. So to me, looking at the body of evidence that, you know, that was out there, I thought this is a great time to do a story that really takes a step back and says, what do we know?
Mm-hmm.
Here's the thing. Feld Entertainment has been sued numerous times over the past decade by anti-cruelty organizations. They haven't been successful so far.
Mm-hmm.
But what they have been successful in doing is daylighting a lot of records.
Yeah, it's really forced the release of stuff that I'm sure Feld and company would have done anything not to have to release. And as you point out in your story, they stonewalled as far as they could before the judge finally said, okay, now the Feld executives may be doing some jail time and some other problems if we don't get those records. And,
exactly. Yeah. And the federal government also had been very reticent to release under the Freedom of Information Act records that it held in its files concerning its investigation of evidence brought to it by whistleblowers, by local humane authorities, by animal rights organizations with undercover videos.
Mm-hmm.
They had a lot of records in their files that they also didn't want the public to see. But through this litigation, all that came out.
Yeah.
Now, the advantage I have as a journalist is that while those cases weren't successful for various reasons, the biggest one wasn't successful because the judge didn't believe that the people who sued had standing, had the right to sue
mm-hmm.
on behalf of the elephants in court. But as a journalist, that doesn't matter to me. My only question was, what do these records show about the lives these elephants lead? And the job that regulators have performed in protecting those elephants.
And protecting, I may just take the liberty of putting in quotes, as you document in your article. Let me just quickly say, this is Talking Animals. If you just tuned in, we're speaking with Deborah Nelson, a Pulitzer-winning reporter who wrote a major expose for Mother Jones magazine about the Ringling Circus, which not coincidentally opens its Tampa engagement tonight. If you'd like to join the conversation, ask Deborah a question or offer a comment, please call 813-239-9663 or email dj@wmnf.org. Yeah, just to sort of pick up on that, Deborah, because I mean, one of the themes kind of bubbling underneath the surface of your piece is fear, and it just seems like there's a lot of fear in different quarters. And although you don't say so, really, I mean, the USDA and the folks who supposedly were sort of charged with the responsibility of you know, looking after and looking out for really the animals. You know, I guess partly just they were just fearful of the sort of power and money and just the monolithic beast that is Feld Entertainment.
I mean, Feld Entertainment is a, you know, $500,000 to $1 million giant entertainment company that has never been shy about spending money to fight the government, to fight animal rights. I mean, they went all the way to the Supreme Court. They took the state of Utah all the way to the Supreme Court over Utah's use of the slogan "Greatest Snow on Earth." So I think with an organization that has that kind of money and is not afraid to use it, there's probably a natural fear that they'll use it against you. And not only are they a company with a long record of litigation, spending a lot of money on litigation. They also pour tens of thousands of dollars into public relations to promote themselves and also to attack their critics. And finally, they, you know, in the late 1990s, they were operating a multimillion-dollar undercover surveillance operation that planted moles in animal rights groups and also worked to block a journalist from writing about the Feld family.
Just those three things you mentioned, I think, are each sort of almost full-length, probably Talking Animal shows, if not beyond. But let's, because a couple of them actually sort of merge, really. And as you do note in the article, I mean, Kenneth Feld and the Feld Entertainment Corporation has employed some pretty draconian methods to to damage the careers and lives of journalists and authors who've done unfavorable articles, TV pieces, books. And I guess before we get further into that, I'm curious, at what point, if any, were you worried knowing that, you know, that they've taken some pretty, you know, dark steps in that direction as you were really, you know, delving into this?
That really wasn't a concern for me because this is a story that was built entirely on, almost entirely, on their own records and on government records.
Yeah.
And that provides a pretty strong foundation on their own testimony.
Right, right. And also, did we mention that you're a Pulitzer winner? So that probably provided a little extra cushion too.
Maybe.
Yeah, but the other thing too that you note that sort of hooks into that is, I don't know that this has happened as much in recent years, but yeah, some years ago, yeah, they actually, if there was an organization or more, you know, certainly that was making some headway or making some noise about Ringling's, abuse or treatment of animals, they would find a way to get operatives kind of in those organizations, and it's like a spy operation.
Yeah.
And pretty amazing, really.
Now when it comes to the treatment of elephants, when I interviewed two top officials from the USDA, which is in charge of overseeing the Animal Welfare Act and enforcing it. When I talked to them about why it is that, more than a dozen investigations didn't produce any action, more than a dozen investigations in as many years by the agency produced no action against Feld Entertainment. Harrowing accounts from whistleblowers, as I mentioned before, their own investigators asked for action. That's what the internal records showed. The uncovered baby elephants bound and bruised down in at the Center for Elephant Conservation in Florida, being separated from their mothers. They discovered their own inspectors, USDA's own inspectors, investigated the deaths of several elephants, a baby lion. Their inspectors uncovered, wounds on elephants and lameness. There was quite a body of evidence just within the USDA's own files, yet nothing led to action against Feld Entertainment. And when I asked about that, each of them said it's a big organization.
Mm-hmm.
It's a big, powerful company. And you know they're going to fight it. And so you better make sure you have a strong case before you take action against them.
But doesn't it seem, in reading again your incredibly sort of wide and deep reporting this, I was just struck on that part. About that was their response, but the sort of unspoken but implied response is, so generally speaking, we're not even going to try. We're not going to even pursue this. And, they almost had to, really sort of be backed into a corner, it seemed, before they would.
Well, the good news,
I guess,
is that since the story came out, the USDA took action against Ringling on November, I think it was November 30th, at the end of November.
Yeah.
They announced the biggest penalty in the history of the Animal Welfare Act in its 40 years of $270,000 against Feld Entertainment to settle a couple dozen allegations of mistreatment of animals.
Yeah.
And violations of the Animal Welfare Act.
Right, and I you're sort of too nice and kind of modest to say so, but I think everybody that follows this world and has followed the Ringling situation for years and years would all, I think, agree that, that's directly attributable to your Mother Jones piece. Talk about being forced into to acting and forced into a corner. That's exactly, I think, what the piece did. So,
but I think it's a combination of what I've found over the years is if I write about an issue and there's an active constituency who cares about it, that leads to action. I mean, it kind of takes a village to raise Cain, right?
Yeah.
And so, so what, you know, the animal anti-cruelty organizations and local humane authorities and investigators within the USDA had been pushing for years for the agency to take action. And they had built this body of evidence that I wrote about. And so I don't want to minimize, I want to shine the light on that.
Sure.
What my story did was write about the evidence that had been accumulated through the efforts of hundreds of people over the past more than a decade.
Right. No, and absolutely. And they should also get kudos, but it really did take someone to really do some serious digging and kind of, as you said a few minutes ago, step back and say, okay, really, what do we have here? And then kind of collect and assemble and present it, which is, you know, among the many, you know, amazing, great things that your piece did. So, and again, that I think really there's a direct line from that to that $270,000 penalty, which again, I mean, we should say, sadly, you know, it was practically pocket change to to the Feld folks, but it's still it's something and it's significant, and you know, that's you'd like to think you can sort of build on that. So.
Step in the right direction.
Yeah, yeah. And so, again, this is, I'm Duncan Truss. My guest is Deborah Nelson, a Pulitzer-winning investigative reporter who wrote a significant expose about the Ringling Brothers Circus for Mother Jones. We invite you to join the conversation by calling 813-239-9663 or emailing dj@wmnf.org. So let's get into something else you kind of alluded to, is their gigantic, well, money, but related to that, their gigantic public relations machine. And, I mean, I've been talking about this for years on the show, but I mean, I have to say, it pains me to say it, but they're pretty ingenious. I mean, they're really, really good at this. And, you know, but I've never really had a chance to discuss it on air with the journalists as experienced and accomplished as you are, because, I mean, it just seems like, I mean, among the many things that they do, which, somehow, maybe it makes more sense with the current landscape of journalism and maybe print journalism in particular, but they somehow end up in bed with media people of all stripes who almost seem hypnotized, you know, and, you know, they're, next thing you know, they're riding on top of an elephant for the 11 o'clock local news, or they're, you know, singing the praises in print. And I'm just thinking, wow, how does that happen exactly? And,
well, you know, journalists are, you know, we're like your average human being. We're average humans.
Yeah.
And just as there's a romance about the circus, I think, among the general population, there's plenty of journalists, you know, have that sense of romance as well. How, you know, the New York Times did a story in the last, sometime in the last year, in which the reporter said, you know, there may be some issues with the way the elephants are treated, but they sure do look majestic as they step out of the train cars.
Yeah.
These are train cars where they spend a good part of their lives, you know, cramped and chained sometimes for days at a time, as long as 3 days at a time without a break.
Yeah.
But that's not what the story talked about. The story talked about what the reporter saw standing outside the train cars. He saw a majestic, you know, the majestic elephant stepping majestically out of the train car. If he knew, or if you knew what that elephant had just been there to get, had just been through to get to the latest circus venue in New York City, you probably wouldn't describe it as majestic.
YeYeah, and that's the thing. There's that iconic front page photo of the elephant or parade of elephants from the train station that, you know, I mean, it's like clockwork. You're going to see it just about every year in one or more publications as the circus comes to town. And you know, speaking of that, one of the things that although they weren't completely juxtaposed, but I'm going to juxtapose them here. But one of the things that you note in your article is that, yeah, as you've just kind of alluded to more generally, the train trips, I mean, the circus travels by train, and so, of course, that means all the elephants and other animals travel by train. And you note that the average train trip is 26 hours straight, and that some are 70-plus hours or even more without a break sometimes, and, of course, means these elephants and other animals, but especially the elephants, are you know, standing in their waste for all those hours. And back to the money and the power and influence of Ringley at another part of the story when you're talking about the suits and some of the people testifying on Ringling's behalf. There is this professor who testified that likely enjoyed the train trips because it satisfied their quote-unquote nomadic urge to roam. And it's like, really? And then you also note that it turns out under questioning, this guy revealed that he was being paid $500 an hour by Feld to provide this kind of expert testimony. So.
Yeah, the judge was a little skeptical of that testimony. It was the person that Feld Entertainment put on as one of their leading experts. And yes, he did, he said, well, this satisfies their nomadic urge to roam. And when the Feld Entertainment attorney took that argument up with the judge, continued it, he compared them, putting on the judge said, well, they're in chains. It's not, you know. Oh, the attorney said, it's like taking a car trip.
Yeah.
Your family's going on vacation, you know. You get in the car, you put on the seatbelt. And the judge says, well, the elephants are in chains. And he said, well, that's just like a seatbelt. And he said, well, when you're on a family trip, you're not sitting in your own excrement.
Yeah. I think
that, you know, I talked to Dr. Friend after that. We had a conversation. And I think that he reflects, his comments reflect an kind of, to be charitable, old-fashioned view of our relationship with animals.
Mm-hmm.
In that conversation, he said, well, you know, it's like when you're trying to teach your dog to do something, you have a dog, right? You hit it. And I said, no, I don't hit it.
Mm-hmm.
He said, well, it's like, you know, if your child is misbehaving, you spank them. Well, I don't spank my child either.
Yeah.
But it's an old-fashioned mindset that certainly, the people are questioning, well, it goes beyond people questioning. People have been questioning that mindset since the 70s, and actually well before that if you go back in history. But a growing number of people don't accept that mindset. And yet the circus is stuck in the pre-70s era, putting on a show with wild animals. And while people enjoy seeing wild animals, they now want them treated nicely. And Feld Entertainment can't really deliver that because you can't make animals do what they want the animals to do by being nice to them through positive reinforcement, despite what they say.
Right, and also an important related part of that, I think, too, is back to what I was suggesting earlier about kind of this through line maybe of fear, that. I at least sort of felt was underneath the surface of your piece is Feld's, and Ringling's fear is, if something were really to succeed with these kind of suits and some other stuff, that the elephants wouldn't really be allowed to be in the circus. I mean, they couldn't be more fearful of that. And at one point, you report that the Feld executives said that the elephants generate more than $100 million in annual revenues. I mean, that's a staggering figure. Do you know, by the way, how that, I mean, that seemed like such an odd thing to sort of break out from the circus and their overall revenues. Do you know how they determined that or calculated that?
I don't know how they calculated that. And that's, that's their own assessment. It may
yeah.
be higher or lower. What I don't know is whether it includes revenues from, sales of products. If you've gone to the circus, and I went to the circus, I went to see one of the Ringling circuses when I began research on this. I hadn't been for years and years,
mm-hmm.
and And, you know, you can buy elephants in all forms in the concession stands, elephant cups, elephant lights.
Sure.
You know, elephant. The elephants, you know, have become the kind of iconic image of the circus.
Sure.
Symbol of the circus. And they bank on that. On the other hand, what impressed me was how great the show was, separate from the animals. Made me wonder why do they really still need the animals? And interestingly, in one of the lawsuits, the one in which the ASPCA and API and others sued Feld Entertainment under the Endangered Species Act,
mm-hmm.
One of the sets of documents they got from Feld Entertainment was letters from circus goers. And that viewpoint was expressed over and over again in those letters. Do you really need the elephants?
Hmm.
These are just from your average circus goers. There's one fellow who started his letter out or his email out saying, I'm not a PETA freak, but I took my kids to the circus. And the elephants look so sad. My kid asked me, why do the elephants look so sad?
Mm.
Do you really need to have animals? The rest of the show is great.
That's so interesting, and that letter sounds so poignant. And I think that's what a lot of us have said. It's like, hey, we're not against the circus. We're just kind of not, you know, we're against circuses that use animals. And back to sort of that old school thing that you're talking about more in the professor, I think the ringling from, you know, Kenneth Feld probably on down just could not possibly find a way in their reasoning to accept that the circus could still flourish without the elephants. And so they're clinging furiously, I think, to those. And I guess on a sort of a related note, I just want to be sure to mention that starting tonight and really for the duration of the Ringling Run in Tampa, there will be protests, which I know are always done very respectfully and peacefully, and sort of back to that same point you were just raising, Deborah, which is that, you know, people are just, it's explained to them what goes on with the elephants. Many folks do not know, and I've seen people, when I've done this, turn right around, even with the purchase tickets in hand, and say, well, you know, in that case, we're not gonna go. We're not gonna do it. And, anyway, so there is the first of these protests is at the former St. Pete Times Forum, now Tampa Times Forum, on 401 Channelside Drive, and it's going to get underway at 6:30. And you can go to there's a few different organizations involved. You can go to floridavoicesforanimals.org and find out more information and details if you want to participate in either the one tonight other parts of the circus's performance in Tampa. But we're just sort of nearing the end of our time, but we do have some callers and emailers. Let me see if we can quickly work them into the show, too. Hi, you're on Talking Animals with Deborah Nelson.
Is it me?
Yeah, I know you've been holding a long time. Thanks for your patience. Do you have a question or comment for Deborah?
Comment. P.T. Barnum said there's a sucker born every minute, and he joined forces with Ringling, and that's what they're counting on, is all these people being suckers and going to a show. Exploiting animals. I'm with Florida Voices for Animals. We do demos, and every time we hand out stuff to people, they say, don't spoil our fun. They just don't want to be educated. I don't understand why. There are a few people that do turn around and walk away, but so few. So what we really have to do is get out and educate the people. And, you know, when PETA say to me, or people say to me, PETA is so bad. Well, PETA gets in their face, and they get people to see what is going on. And as far as the newspapers and the TV, they get paid by Ringling. They have ads on TV and in the newspaper. They're not going to go against their money.
Absolutely.
That's the problem.
Right. Okay. Well, that's absolutely right. Thank you so much for your call and your comment. And, Deborah, I mean, we just sort of have maybe a minute or so left here total, but that's another thing, too, is what I alluded to before, and I'm able to quickly come back to that in light of this caller's comments, is that, I do think, especially what's happening in the newspaper business, that there just can't be coincidental. I mean, Ringling takes out a lot of ads when they come to town, And, I know at the Better Newspapers there's a real wall between editorial and advertising, but, boy, it sure seems like there's quite a connection these days, and that's an important source of revenue for these papers, and the same thing, I think, with local television outlets as well.
I mean, I would hope that isn't an influence, but, certainly down in Florida, where they're a big force, in the economy down there, it's their headquarters. Actually, I don't know if they're a big force in the economy down there. You may know that better than I do, but they're a citizen of Florida and a prominent one.
Yeah.
That certainly may influence, how they're covered.
Sure. Well, and even when I lived in Southern California, it was much the same way, and that was enough years ago that, the newspaper biz, et cetera, hadn't, experienced quite the number of blows that it has in recent years. But
what I found actually was a bigger problem for me, and over the years I've seen this is the case, there's a disinterest among editors in writing about treatment of animals, animal cruelty stories.
Mm-hmm.
So that's, to me, that's a bigger obstacle to getting the truth out than influence and money from Ringling. There's a bias against these sorts of stories, as for whatever reason. They consider them too soft, too warm and fuzzy. Caring
right.
about animals isn't, political corruption. But it's a hard sell. It's a hard sell to editors.
It is a hard sell, and I also think maybe unfairly, but that also symptomatic of just kind of how tough it is at newspapers. I mean, people, their staffs are just shrunken, and people are, swamped and doing blog posts and other things. But, for example, I'm holding in my hand a section from the Palm Beach Post on Christmas Day, and there's a piece, the circus comes to town, pictures, and, five things you might not know about the circus, and it says, for the love of animals, animals are a critical part of the circus, and Feld Entertainment is devoted, this is a byline piece, by the way, devoted to their welfare. Handlers and staff live with and care for their animals 365 days a year. Ringling has worked especially hard in the area of elephant conservation, building the Center for Elephant Conservation, a 200-acre state-of-the-art facility for endangered Asian elephants. Between 2005 and 2006, Ringling Brothers donated more than $300,000 to the Smithsonian Institute's National Zoo for Elephant Conservation. So, that's just kind of writing directly from a press release. Not aware of anything, not even aware of obviously either your article or it's the $270,000, penalty and I don't know.
It doesn't reflect independent reporting.
Right. Sure. So, but I just think that's happening more and more. And so again, the big machine that is Ringling just, plows ahead and, gets nice big audiences. And anyways, but the thing is articles like yours and the impact of those things are we're making headway. And that's how it has to be. It has to sort of be a kind of a, more sustained thing because it's up against a very, very, as you say, powerful and wealthy force. And so, Deborah, thank you again for making the time to join us on. I'm sorry if I cut you off.
Yeah, thanks to you for continuing to shine the light on these things.
Oh, well, I appreciate that, and again, appreciate your time, and really, really appreciate your piece, and I just hope anyone who hasn't had a chance to read it yet can just find it online. Again, it was in the November-December issue of Mother Jones magazine. This has been Deborah Nelson. Thanks again, Deborah.
Hey, thank you.
All right.
See ya.
I'm sorry we didn't get to some of the callers and emailers, but anyway, we will carry on now. I'm Duncan Strauss, and... You're listening to Talking Animals, where the show website is talkinganimals.net. It's time to proceed to Name That Animal Tune. Will be a prize, a David Bowie Best of CD, which directly hooks to We Can Be Heroes, our three-night, three-city David Bowie tribute taking place this weekend, Friday at the State Theater in St. Petersburg, Saturday at Skippers in Tampa, Sunday at the Cock and Bull in Sarasota. You get more tickets, more info and tickets at WMNF.org. The first person who calls 813-239-9663 and correctly identifies this animal tune featuring a musician who's recorded and toured with Bowie. It's Name That Animal Tune on Talking Animals.
Articulate announcements. It's all
All right, we have just about reached the end of today's edition of Talking Animals on WNF Tampa. We'll be back next Wednesday, January 11th, when our guest will be Bob Barker, mentioned earlier, former host of The Price is Right, underwritten a huge array of animal welfare organizations and projects from promoting spay and neuter through his DJ&T Foundation for years and years to more recently doing things encouraging the teaching of animal laws we talked about also, and monies for the Sea Shepherd Conservation Society to purchase that new ship to combat Japanese whalers. And that's just some of the stuff. So we'll talk with Bob Barker next Wednesday here on Talking Animals. I hope you'll join us then. I also hope you'll visit our website, talkinganimals.net, where we make available all sorts of information as well as archives and podcasts of past Talking Animals programs. We also have a link to the Talking Animals Facebook page, our Twitter feed, and more. That's all found at talkinganimals.net. Talking Animals broadcast outreach consultant is Libby McKenna. My thanks to her. Thanks very much for listening. Have a good week. Be kind to animals. Be kind to others. Be kind to yourself. And stay tuned. It'll be the All Souls edition of It's the Music, airing next from noon to 3 in a breaking development. I'll be filling in for Scott today. And first music show will be done in more than a year, so yikes! Anyways, closing out today's show as always with an animal tune. This is Samba Salad with Biggie Kamen. Take us up to the NPR News. It's Talking Animals. It's WMNF Tampa. We'll see you next week.